Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Today, Loverboy's Mike Reno talks 40-plus years of touring, making music, the band's two hit singles, and whether he was invited to participate in Top Gun Maverick. That's all coming up on Endeavors.
You're listening to Endeavors Radio with your host from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Dan McPeak.
There have been a handful of superstar Canadian bands throughout this country's musical history. You have your Tragically Hip, your Rush, Spirit of the West, even solo artists like Paul Anka, Bryan Adams, Gordon Lightfoot. In, you know, the 21st century, even acts like Justin Bieber or Marianas Trench. Bare Naked Ladies as well. Some of them break through into the U.S., some of them only ever really become big in their home country, but they become legends of Canada. One band that has been big in Canada for 40 plus years, but also made it big in the States shortly after their career in this country took off, is the band Loverboy. Of course, Loverboy is known for their two major hits, Turn Me Loose and Working for the Weekend. And they were actually considered one of the founders of the genre known as arena rock. But beyond that, they recorded the song Nothing's Gonna Stop You Now, which was used for the theme song for the United States Olympic team in 84. And they also recorded the song Heaven in Your Eyes, which was featured in the 1986 Tom Cruise vehicle, Top Gun. They have worked with fellow rockers Bryan Adams, Colin James, and Chilliwack, and just recently played a couple of show dates with fellow Canadian icons, Trooper. More recently, their song Loving Every Minute of It was featured in a national car rental commercial with the hilarious Patrick Warburton. A couple of weeks ago, I got to speak with lead singer of Loverboy, Mike Reno, about their status as icons in the Canadian music industry, as well as their current tour. It was a lovely talk, so here is my chat with Loverboy's Mike Reno. Mike Reno, hello, good afternoon, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me, sir.
So, Loverboy is going on another tour. I know you just played in Ontario and you're about to go to Nashville in next week, I believe, or in a week and a half. For you, is this tour different than other tours you've done? I was looking at the dates. I noticed they're more spread out a little bit.
They're only spread out now because we haven't filled in all the blanks, but we generally do 85 shows a year, and it's pretty nonstop for the last 25 years. We've been going 40 years, but in the beginning, we used to play almost every day, which was ridiculous. But that's how you get famous, I guess. You know, you play every day. But so we cut it back to about 85, 90 shows a year, and I consider myself semi-retired. Is that right?
For you, how different is touring now than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Well, we seem to have more fun now because the pressure's off. We had a lot of people breathing down our necks in the old days, management, record companies. We had 34 staff traveling around in five buses, five trucks, and a jet. We had a lot of expenses to pay. We kind of cut it all back, and what we're doing now is the meat and potatoes. We're bringing the songs. We're not bringing the 37 road crew anymore. We're bringing, like, you know, five guys, five band members, and we basically lay it out very simply. We play the songs the way they should be played, and we have a lot of fun. And that's kind of, in a nutshell, what we do.
Your show in Aurelia that you played last week and your show in Moncton in April, you're sharing the stage with Trooper, another great, iconic Canadian band. What's it like playing with those guys, who I'm sure you've encountered a lot over the years?
Oh, they're good friends. Great songs, huh? I was really quite surprised that Trooper didn't break into the United States like we did. They had every chance to with the material they came up with. They've got a lot of hits. But I love playing with them because they're high-energy guys, good friends of ours, known them all these years. Nice to see they're still at it. So it's really fun. We had a good time last weekend when we met up with them in Ontario. Good bunch of guys.
I did mention your next date is Nashville, which for, I think, a lot of musicians is a very important city. It's such a music hub, you know, whether it's country, whether it's rock. What is it about that city you think that is so important for free musicians, and why has it become the hub that it is?
Well, it's kind of centrally located, you know. It's really kind of in the center of the country. It is basically started out full of country, and now it's everything. The city's turning into like a mini Las Vegas for people coming and partying and having bachelor parties and bachelorette parties. Every time I go there, I can't believe how more exciting it gets each time. This time, as last time, we're playing the Ryman Theater, which was the initial Grand Ole Opry. And it's an old Baptist church. Everybody sits in pews, and there's stained glass windows, and the stage is insane. And they used to run that radio show and then TV show out of there for many years. So it's for us, Nashville's a real kick. I mean, there's a lot of music stores. There's a lot of live music. It's all about music, and we love going there.
Is there a difference? Do you notice anything different in either the culture or perhaps the fans when you tour America versus when you're playing at home in Canada?
Well, you know what? It's basically the same. We got a lot of fans in both countries, and the people just love the songs. I find that the audiences are very similar. They get up and they sing and they dance and they shake it up and have a good time. I can't really complain about either country. They just rock out real hard. I'm real happy to play in both countries. There's a lot of more people in America, so we play a lot of different cities. But Canada's, you know, really our first love for sure.
The band initially formed in Calgary. How would you describe Calgary as a music city?
Calgary started out when I left high school, and I started a band in Calgary years ago. There was a band in every pub and every hotel, and it was like very competitive. There was 17 to 25 bands playing all week long, every week. So there was a lot of competition, a lot of creativity going on. You had to be better than the next guy. You had to work a little harder than the next band. It really helped kind of, you know, get my juices flowing. Just so much competition, it really makes you try harder. And a lot of musicians experimenting with a lot of different things. And it was an interesting time. And Calgary is really a great city. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the Denver of the north, or even a bit of the Houston of the north, because it's all about oil and gas. But the people there, hardworking people who like to really have fun when they're not working, which is kind of like sets it up perfectly for rock music.
you sort of joked that you were surprised that Trooper hadn't made it into the States. But for you, for Loverboy, you broke into the States fairly early on in your career with your singles. How much of a surprise was that, and how big was that for you as a band?
Well, I got to be honest with you. When we broke into the States, it happened really quickly, right off the bat. We were lucky enough to have people working with us who had connections in the States, and we got on tours right away through promoters in the southern states. Don Fox, Beaver Productions, he got us on tour with Kansas, which was fabulous, great, one of my favorite bands. So we couldn't even believe what was happening to us. And the record just immediately hit the radio stations, and it was crazy. People couldn't even buy the record because the radio stations were getting it because they heard about us playing. And we actually kind of created, I think, our own popularity just by playing every night some other city all through the United States. And record companies were forced to put the record out, and then it ended up selling millions of records, which is really unheard of. I mean, we kind of created that. A Canadian band coming into the States with really no promotion, and then the radio's picking it up, and the radio's made us famous with us playing live everywhere. People just went, who are these guys? They didn't, and still a lot of people don't even know we're Canadian, even though we're always waving the Canadian flag. They kind of took us on as their as one of their own, for sure.
But is that important to you, to being, I guess, known as a Canadian band that's from Canada rather than just a rock band?
Absolutely, it's important. That's what we are. We're very proud of being Canadians. Are you kidding? We all still live in Canada, pretty much. One guy lives in North Carolina right now, but he's just kind of feeling it out and checking it out and hanging out where his kids are going to college and stuff. But other than that, we're all still good Canadians, waving the flag everywhere we go. We love to tell people where we're from.
You mentioned performing live, and Loverboy has definitely, I think, become known for their energetic live performances. For you, what is the biggest rush of performing live?
Well, to be honest with you, I feel very nervous before concerts. I don't know why. I thought it would get easier. I thought it would get better. But when I'm standing side stage and the lights go out, that to me is the biggest rush. And I know, like, in about 5 seconds, I'm going to be running out on that stage and start singing. And I know that it's a huge rush. It's kind of probably what I think people feel like quarterbacks feel like when they run on the field to start the game, you know. And I can probably compare it to that because, you know, to me, that's where the rush starts. It starts there, and it goes for like an hour and a half. And it's just after the show, I'm in the best mood.
Speaking of rush, can you take us back to that day in 1979, and it's you and 15,000 fans, and you're opening for Kiss.
Oh my gosh, we hadn't even done a record yet. We were brought in as a replacement for, believe it or not, the New York Dolls, who couldn't get across the border. They had some problems at the border. Kiss came in. New York Dolls weren't allowed to come through for whatever reason. I imagine I know a few of the reasons, but, you know, use your imagination. It's the New York Dolls, after all. And so we got a call from Bruce Allen, and Bruce was our manager. He said to us, look, guys, get together. You're playing tonight at the Coliseum. And we just went, what do you mean we're playing? We haven't even done a record or anything. We've been in the studio cutting some demos. We didn't even have a bass player at the time. As a matter of fact, for that show, we had to use Jim Clench, the bass player for April Wine, who was a friend of ours, and he was in town hanging out with us, you know, just playing with us in jam sessions and at our rehearsal hall, just to get a feel for the new music that Paul and I and Doug were writing. So it was all a big surprise to us. I almost don't remember it, other than the fact that I walked out and looked at an audience that was all there for Kiss, and they'd never heard of us, and we didn't do too bad considering. It was just a blur. I mean, can you imagine the nerves? I'm nervous as it, anyways. Never mind, you know, that situation. First show, unbelievable. It was unbelievable.
Something that I just learned researching this interview is that the band recorded a song for the film Top Gun, Heaven in Your Eyes. How did that come about for you? Because that's still an iconic film 30 years later.
Well, you know, that's a really great story. I'm glad you brought it up. I was I got a phone call from Paramount Studios saying, could you meet with Don Simpson and Mr. Jerry Bruckheimer? And I went, Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer? You know, because they were doing everything at the time. They'd written everything. They were the number one guys in Hollywood. And I said, sure. So I flew down to California, and I went to Paramount Studios. I get in, which I was surprised that they even had my name at the gate. So I go to this office, and I walk in the room. It's a big office. And there's a real live popcorn machine in the middle of the room. These two guys are walking back and forth, pacing, and they meet each other in the middle, and they talk for a second, and then they walk back and forth the room. And I guess they're figuring out stuff for their movie. You know, they're just doing what they do. And I'm standing there for about 5 minutes before they even realized I was standing there. And then they went, can we help you? And they said, I said, well, you said you wanted to meet me. My name's Michael Reno from the rock group Loverboy. How can I help you? And they said, oh, good, Mike, come over here, come over here. And they took me over in the corner, and they threw a cassette in. And on comes the screen, this scene of a motorcycle screaming up a hill, followed by a little black Porsche. And then they go to a restaurant or bar, and they plop a quarter in the jukebox, and the song comes on. And they looked at me, and they go, can you write a song for this scene? And just because I'm a bit of a ballsy guy, and I always have been, I went, absolutely, I could do that. And I said, when do you need it by? And they said, Thursday. And I said, you guys realize it's Tuesday today, right? And they laughed, and I laughed, and I said, well, I'll head home, and we'll try it. So I phoned the guys, phoned Paul. We got together in the studio with some people we were working with on a few other songs, producers and stuff, and engineers. And they started the song in the studio while I was flying home. And then I got there, and I started working it out, writing the lyrics and singing it. And by golly, we sent it off to them by Thursday. And they went, thank you. And it ended up on the soundtrack, which was huge. I mean, the soundtrack sold millions and millions, like 20-some-odd million copies.
Yeah, didn't the soundtrack reach the top 10?
Absolutely. It was one of the biggest sellers ever. I mean, it was just a... And this was like... I guess the reason they probably asked us is because I'd done something for Footloose a few years before, and that was the Almost Paradise song with Ann Wilson, and it went pretty big, and it was also in a movie, so maybe they just figured, let's get these guys. They had big success with another song. So,
were you asked at all to be involved with the Top Gun sequel? Is the song going to be involved at all? I know. Danger. We know that Danger Zone is going to be back. Any news on whether Loverboy is going to be back?
Well, you know, they didn't ask us to come back, but I wrote a song for them anyways, and I cut it, and I sent it to them, and they do have the demo of the song that I wrote for them, and I hope they use it. If they use it, I'll be very happy. I wrote it especially for the movie like that. It's all about, I kind of wrote it as far as jets go. You know, it sounds like there's jets flying in the song. I mean, it's one of those songs. I wrote it with Jim Petterick from Survivor. He wrote Eye of the Tiger and a bunch of stuff for 38 Special and Heavy Metal with Sammy Hagar. It was kind of one of those, he says, let's write a song for this movie. And I said, absolutely, that's kind of why I wanted to get together with you. So I went to Chicago and I did it on my break last summer when we were touring. And it turned out really well. I hope they use it. It's got a really... really cool kind of name that's kind of attached to the military. It's called Without a Bullet Being Fired, and that would be a great song for their soundtrack. But then again, what do I know what they're going to put together? They may put together a whole different kind of aspect, you know, like they may put together Beyonce for all I know. how do I know? I got no control over it. What I could do is write songs and send them in. Whether they use them or not is their business.
How would you describe your overall process as a songwriter, both, you know, when you write songs on your own and when you collaborate with Paul?
Right, songwriting's kind of hard. It's a hard deal. It's like, it's kind of like going to the dentist. You really don't want to sit down and start doing it. But as soon as you're finished, you feel great. And that's kind of how I always put it. It's been my whole life like that. So performing live is really what I love to do. Songwriting is a challenge, but I do it, and I'm happy I did it. But it's not an easy process. It's like excruciating. But when you get it right, it feels great.
You had alluded to bass playing earlier, and I wanted to get your, you know, when Scott passed in 2000, that was obviously very tough. What made the decision for you to continue on as a group, and what made Spider the right choice to come in and continue this journey with the band?
Well, when it happened, we were all in shock. I was especially in shock. Scott was my best friend, and I had a hard time. I went down and searched for him for a week. I reported back to his family, and it was just a negative bummer. Low, low point. I couldn't even believe it happened, and it was an accident, and it was terrible. And then I sat there in shock for a couple of months, and everybody knew that it was going to be my decision what happened, just because we were so tight. And I just let it kind of happen naturally. I said to myself, I just got to take a break here and think about this. And during that time, I received a lot of letters and emails from fans that said, you know, this is a huge tragedy. One you'll never get over. But a worse tragedy would be if it killed the band, Loverboy Forever, because people really wanted us to continue playing. Because, you know, they like the band, and they like to hear the songs, and they like to see us live. And after reading a lot of these letters and emails, I came to the conclusion that we should probably at least think about, you know, finding another guy. And really, the best bass player for any rock project in Canada would have been Ken Sinise, Spider, as we call him. He's played with the guys before in different bands. He played with Maddie and Tom Cochran. He played with Maddie and Paul in Street Art. He's fantastic. He played with me on a solo album I did that I didn't really release, but I did it. And he was in the studio with me for a month. You know, he was the guy who was just fabulous on the bass. And it turned out that he walked into the rehearsal hall the first day, and he walked over with Scott had given him a bass. And I knew which bass it was, because it was the same one Scott played. It was just a different one. And he came over with this bass, and he said, hold this bass. This is Scotty's bass. And I just kind of melted. And it made it feel right what happened, you know, in that rehearsal hall. That was really the pivotal moment for me. And I realized that we could probably do this. And it was not easy, but we did it.
And it paid off, because 9 years later, Loverboy gets inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame. What was that experience like?
You know what, that was just a fantastic experience. It was a bit nerve-wracking in that it was, you know, in front of like 14,000 people at Rogers Arena in Vancouver. It was televised. It was, but you know what made it comfortable was Bob Rock. He did the whole induction, and Bob Rock was our engineer, and later in life he was our producer for different singles and songs we did. But he's the one who made us sound the way we sound in the beginning, made it sound great, and mixed us great, and went on for, had a huge career of his own, which he still has. When Bob Rock introduced us and started saying nice things, and they showed clips of people in the music business over the years that we'd worked with saying nice things about us, it really made it feel special, and it was a real awesome experience, and I think of it often as a real highlight of my career, for sure. And it was nice to be recognized.
Do you expect country, yeah, that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland will ever come calling anytime soon?
I can't see why not. We play down here all the time. I you know, it's probably just one of those things. You know, I think with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in America, you almost have to have people championing your project. And that's probably even the same in Canada. But it's not a big highlight for me. Like, it doesn't matter to me if I'm in a Hall of Fame as much as it matters that I'm on stage playing for people still. You know, because we're not young chickens anymore. We're getting on. And to be able to go out and play concert tour after concert tour and meet the people and have fun with people and still perform well, sing well, that to me is more important than any award system, because it's really hard to choose between groups like Boston, Foreigner, Cheap Trick. I love them all. You know?
So it, at the end of the day, then, is it really all about the fans for you? Mike, are you still there? Oh, yeah, sorry, it just
I
cut
just
out.
have to change.
Oh, yeah,
Yes,
it
I just
just.
have to change phones.
Oh, no worries.
But the
Yeah,
house.
it just cut out for a minute. I was just asking, because you were talking about, getting up and playing. So at the end of the day, is it all about the fans? Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, just hang on a second. I
Yeah.
just changed phones, so it should be better. I don't know why this phone went dead. Absolutely, it's all about the fans. That's kind of why we do it. We have a great relationship with the fans. To be honest with you, I don't think I would do it if we didn't have the fans. It's all about our relationship with them. They're the ones that bought the records. They're the ones that come to the concerts, and they're the ones that we like to play for. I mean, we play for them. We're nothing without the fans. It's absolutely, it's all about the fans, 100%.
Is it true that the initial name of Working for the Weekend was Waiting for the Weekend, and you were the one that actually suggested the change?
Oh yeah, I just started singing it that way. Paul looks at me, he goes, "What are you saying?" I said, "I'm singing Working for the Weekend. It sounds better. Waiting for the Weekend is kind of like this. I don't know. I don't get it." And he goes, "Fuck, that's awesome." Pardon my French, but you know what I mean? It's like, wow, that was kind of one of those moments, when you're writing and arranging a song, and somebody goes, "That just made it so much better. Thank you, man." It's like, so, yeah, that's how it happened, and it happens like that a lot with me. Paul and I write together a lot. Some things start one way and end another way. But that's how it works.
And I know, I think it was in 1990, was it? Or early 90s, Loverboy got the SNL treatment in a skit with Chris Farley and Patrick Swayze. Especially on such an iconic show like that, where everybody gets, lampooned or honored in some way. What was being on that show in that way like for you as a band?
Well, it was huge. I mean, that made us like one of the gang, right? We did it. We were also on the show a couple of times, which was also a lot of fun. But the piece you're talking about with those two doing the dance and the skit, the way the skit was, it goes in all the classic, anniversary shows. They always mention it, and they always play it, and everybody loves it. And the first time that I saw it was after a gig somewhere. I was packing up my suitcase for the next morning. I had to fly to a different town. And as I'm packing up, Saturday Night Live is on. I'm sitting there packing, watching Saturday Night Live, and it comes on, and it floored me. I had to sit down. I almost pissed my pants. It's unbelievable. It was amazing. It was fun.
And I know recently your song and the band appeared in a was it National Car Rental commercial, which is quite funny. You got to work with Patrick Warburton and him on a minute. But how do you feel about music and art being used as a promotional tool or to sell something?
Well, if it works, I think it's great. Really, it's just all about the sense of humor. And he's a funny guy. Patrick Warburton's a funny guy. I loved his commercials before. And when we got asked to do one, I just went, wow, that's so awesome. We really enjoyed ourselves. We had a lot of fun together. But really, when you think about this guy, doing his thing about how he likes to be in control of everything, and he sits in the car and he looks over, and Loverboy's sitting in his car, crammed in the front and the back seats, and he goes, "And like my good friends in Loverboy say, I'm loving every minute of it." And then we start waving our arms out the window, and sparklers and flares are going off as we drive off the lot. I mean, that to me was funny. And I'll be involved with anything that's funny like that. I think that's great. And, it's been a few times in our career when they've used it. And they've used us a lot of our songs in movies. And they seem to work, so it makes me happy.
How was it flexing your acting muscles in that way?
Nothing, that was nothing to it. You know, I try not to act. I try to react. He looked at me. I smiled at him. Our arms were out the window, and that was the end of that. Don't think we said anything. Super easy. That was super easy. He was a natural guy to work with. When people make you feel comfortable like that, it's always easy.
I know that the band has written a few has released a few singles over the last couple of years. Are we gonna see a full album anytime soon, do you think?
Well, I'd like to go in the studio and cut a record as a group from the ground up, as opposed to doing emailing sessions back and forth to people and seeing what you want, how to, and then releasing singles. There was a time maybe a while back when I thought singles were really the only way to go, because it seemed to me that people didn't have the concentration factor anymore to listen to 10 songs in a row. And maybe they still don't, I don't know. But I like doing albums. I think it represents, a period of time. And there was a time when I didn't feel like doing it anymore, but now I'm starting to feel like it again. So I could see us doing another album maybe in the next few years.
I think Paul has described your new song, Some Like It Hot, as Loverboy's only shuffle. What can you tell us about that song?
It's a shuffle. It was a jam session shuffle, and we just started making up words and say. I just started making up words and singing along, and then it ended up being like 7 or 8 minutes long. And we said, "Well, that'll never be a single, so we'll put it off to the side." It's a song we've had for a while, and we decided just to look at it again. And Paul was into mixing it, so he mixed it and made it sound kind of interesting. So we put it on our website. We're not really selling that kind of stuff. We're just giving it away on our website, which I think is kind of a neat thing to do, considering that people who seem to be getting your music anyways, if not free, almost free. So we're just handing it out as like a little gift to our fans who go to our website.
But speaking of your long career, you've got the new hits, you've got the old hits. Do you still enjoy playing the songs from 30, 40 years ago?
I love it, man. You see the reactions when we start these songs. There's a long intro for Turn Me Loose. People go out of their mind when they hear the hi-hat and the keyboard intro. They know exactly what's coming. And it's one of those songs that creeps in on you, right? Starts with the keyboards and hi-hat cymbals. Then in comes the bass, in comes the guitar, then in comes everybody, and then out comes me singing the songs. And everybody sings every word. I could put the mic out and they could sing the whole song. It's the same with Working for the Weekend when they hear the cowbell. It's the same for Hot Girls in Love. It's the same for The Kid Is Hot Tonight. They love these songs. When It's Over, This Could Be the Night. Yeah, we've had a nice string of hits, and the crowd, the way the crowd reacts to them just makes it worth it. I love singing these songs. I'll just keep doing it.
You're at the point in your career now where you are influential for a lot of, new musicians, up and coming songwriters. How do you feel about that?
I think it's a responsibility that we have. I'm quite honored that people think about songwriting when they think about listening to Loverboy songs. I could say the same for groups like Foreigner, Cheap Trick, 38 Special, a lot of these big groups that I love, Kansas. I could sit and listen to a Kansas song and say, how did they write that song? It's brilliant. And, Foreigner, every time I hear a Foreigner on the radio, I just crank it up and go, this is the perfect rock song. And Cheap Trick, they kick and they rock and they sing so great. I think it's cool that the young people are listening to some of us classic rock guys and, picking up a few hints, because where else would you go to if you want to listen to some songs that got some sustainability? They seem to have legs. We're still at it after 40 years. Something must be right.
Well, it's funny you mentioned classic rock, because I know both Turn Me Loose and Working for the Weekend have sort of helped almost invent the genre of arena rock. When did it sink in that you were sort of the beginning of a new era or perhaps a new genre of music in a way?
Well, when radio and not so much radio, but press and everything used to get on the band and say, these guys are corporate rock, as if it was a bad word. And I said to myself all the way along, or they're arena rock. I said, that to me says that a lot of people want to hear these guys and that they've done very well. Those are the kind of comments that they're trying to make you feel bad about. But I never, ever felt bad about being considered an arena rock band. or a corporate rock band. Corporate means you've sold so many records, you've almost become a corporation in itself. So that to me is a compliment. But they tried to make it a negative, and I just don't see any negativity in it. It just means that a lot of people really like you, and we work really hard to keep it that way.
Speaking of selling so many records, you've had four platinum albums. What was it like when you found out that you sold your millionth album?
It was a big day. It was like, it's like almost like a day. You can't even believe how great that feels. It's just like insane. I feel a little sad for the kids nowadays because they don't really know what they're selling because people are just listening and they're spinning. And I don't ever see any sales. I don't understand how it works. You know, I look at Billboard and it's just different. It's not like they've sold a million records. It's like they've had a million listens. How does that make you feel? I don't get that, but I'll tell you what, selling a million records makes you feel great.
We briefly talked earlier about, you know, Loverboy being an influence. And I know Paul's talked that one of the influences for him was Jim Cale of the another great Canadian band, Guess Who. What about for you when you first started out, both as a performer and a songwriter? Was there anybody that you looked up to?
Absolutely, I looked up to Paul Rodgers from the group Free. Free was before Bad Company. Paul Rodgers is is my favorite singer, and I love the way they put songs together, and I love the way he sang. So he was a big influence for me, and it changed a lot of the ways I thought about my future. So I kind of just thought it was fabulous to listen to what he did. Of course, I love Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin and all the groups that were coming up. I started off on drums and singing, so I was the drummer singer, and they made me go up front and without the drums. And I said, okay, I got to change my whole way of doing things here because I was comfortable sitting behind the drums for many years. But when I started some other groups, the group before Loverboy, I sang with Moxie. I stood up front, which wasn't easy for me because I came from a position of standing or sitting behind the drums and playing. So I made the move, and I used all my favorite singers, and I kind of used them as influences, and I kind of made it happen.
You alluded a little bit earlier to, you know, young people making music today. How different is the business? Is it easier? Is it harder to survive as a musician?
Well, I don't know how they pay their bills because people don't seem to buy anything anymore. They rent it or they subscribe to it. But if you're good enough to go on tour and get people to come into the room and experience it with you, that's fabulous. But not all the musicians can do that nowadays. You used to be able to sell some records, and then the record sales would get you to go on the road because it would provide you with a bit of an income to go on the road. And then things followed each other. But I think there's something missing in the business today. I think it would be a lot harder nowadays to make it than it was in the old days. But that's just my opinion. I don't know if it's the actuality. But there are a lot of interesting things about the music scene today. Like, you could be a YouTube star and you don't even have to spend a penny. You just have to go in your backyard and cut a great YouTube video with a great song. But, you know, that doesn't happen to everybody.
Is that why touring is still so important, you think?
Just 1 second. Plane flying by. Years ago, but we don't want to because we like playing music and we like traveling around. Well, the traveling gets to us after a while. It's a bit of a pain in the butt, you know, sitting on airplanes and staying in hotels and driving back and forth to shows. But for us, we get to go out and do it. And, you know, it sure beats retired. I mean, what are we going to do for retired? Just sit around the house? I don't think so. So for us, the live shows are really what it's all about. We did our record selling in the good old days when people bought records. So now it's touring, and we just love it. Which is great, because if we hated it, we'd be in a real pickle, wouldn't we?
Over the 40 years you've been together, do you have a favorite and a funniest moment from the tour?
Absolutely. Well, I got a few favorite and a few funnies, but I remember the one time we were down in Mexico. We just finished the record, and three of us went down with our girlfriends to have a little, you know, finish the record, celebrate, go to the beach, you know, have a beer, hang out. And we got called back after being down there for 3 days. We got a call to come to the office to get a phone call. Now, I know this sounds silly, but this is before cell phones, so you actually had to go to the office to get the phone call. So I went up to get the phone call, and our manager, Bruce Allen, says, "Mike, get the guys together. I want you in Los Angeles tomorrow. I already got you guys tickets, pack your bags, you got to go." So we just did that. The girls stayed down there. We went to Los Angeles, and we were on the American Bandstand with Dick Clark, and he loved the band. We were nervous as hell, but we did it. We went on, we played. He came up, and he said, "You guys, I can't believe you guys are so great, and you're from Canada. Tell me about that." You know, that was a huge highlight for us, because American Bandstand, at the beginning, years ago, was a step-off point. If you made American Bandstand, there's a good chance you were going to be a successful group of guys. And that's just how it was back then, which was, how do you forget a moment like that? And then we got asked back again to do another one. We presented Dick Clark with the gold album, and Matty, our drummer, brought it from behind the drums after we played the song, and he said, "Wow, great to have you guys back. You guys are going right to the top with this song." And then we handed him this gold record, and he almost started crying. He said, "You know, I've been in the business a long time. Nobody's ever given me one of these on the air, you know, like this." So that was kind of a neat thing to have happen. I'll never forget that.
So this thing was about your tour, and I know you said all the dates haven't been filled in yet. I know there's one Canadian date right now in Moncton. Any other planned shows in Canada over this tour?
Well, 2 days after that, we're playing Halifax.
Okay.
On the 6th, I believe. The 4th is Moncton. The 6th is Halifax. And, yeah, we're playing Kelowna. We're doing, like, Rock the Lake. We're playing all over the country. It's just, they're just starting to come in now. I mean, it's January, right? Yeah. So what happens now is everything starts coming in. I noticed there's 47 shows on the books right now. But, you know, in 2 months, there'll be 77. And then as the year goes on, there'll be 90, like there always is. So look forward to seeing us. We always play Canada. We always play a lot of shows in Canada every year. So especially in the summer months, you know, when it's nice out, we do a lot of outdoor shows. I think we're playing Manitoba this year in Manitoba. So it's all going to be fun. We're looking forward to doing it all, too.
And finally, I'm wondering if I could just get a few words from you on Neil Peart.
Oh, I was so sad to hear about this. Sadly, it came just after my birthday. January the 8th is my birthday. I understand they released the fact that he passed away the day before my birthday. And on the 10th, it was a sad day for all of us. A couple of us wore Rush t-shirts on stage for the concert. It was kind of one of those things. And how do you feel when somebody, like, he didn't even tell anybody he was sick. He probably told his bandmates and stuff. But I just recently watched the R40, which is their movie they did. I think it was their last tour. And I recommend everybody watching it. Fabulous. It really explains a lot of things about the group Rush, one of Canada's best, if not Canada's best rock band. I was completely verklempt. I was sad and really mournful. What a great guy, high energy. He had a lot of disappointment in his life, and he had a lot of tragedy, but he sure had a lot of great concerts and a lot of fans out there. I think the whole country, the whole world will miss Neil Peart from Rush.
Do you think you could see yourselves doing a Rush song at one of your Canadian shows, just as a tribute?
I'd love to if we could play it. Those songs aren't easy.
Fair.
A good idea. I'll run it up the flagpole and see who's
who. Well, Mike Reno, Loverboy, you're starting your next date is in Nashville on Thursday, January 23rd. Listeners can check out loverboyband.com for complete tour details as more shows come in. Mike Reno, thank you so much for your time today.
They're revving up our jets now. Can't wait to see you guys out there. Appreciate talking with you. I had fun.
All righty, have a good day. Cheers.
Thanks.
That was my interview with Loverboy's Mike Reno. Please visit their website to find out if they are coming to a city near you. That does it for me today. My guest on my next show will be documentarian David Barnhart, talking about his documentary on the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. That's all for today. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.